From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up today, what would it mean to us in Michigan if our country goes off the fiscal cliff?
It is certainly not Armageddon. And even cliff is awfully strong. Maybe we should call it a fiscal ramp or a fiscal slide.
Plus, we continue our series on paying for higher education. What happens when you default on your student loans?
I wish someone had said you could probably be more aggressive in looking for scholarships. Scholarship planning does not end when you graduate from high school.
And we meet a man who's been photographing the shoreline of the Great Lakes, all 10,000 miles of them.
I really do think there are different personalities to the lakes, and I think the citizens that live in and around those Great Lakes drive those personalities.
All of those stories on today's Stateside, but first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, we'll meet a man who has been photographing the shoreline of the Great Lakes all 10,000 miles. And as we continue our series on higher education, we hear about one woman's struggle to pay off her student debt almost a decade after graduation. But first, how about this? Some encouraging economic news about our state for us all to talk about. Today, it was announced that U.S. consumer confidence rose this month to its highest level in almost 5 years, pushed up by steady improvements in hiring. And new U.S. Commerce Department reports show the economic recovery appears to be taking root here in Michigan. Per capita personal income rose in nearly every county in Michigan last year. Here to translate the economic speak for us and put it into real-life context is Michigan State University economics professor Charlie Ballard. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you. Glad to be on the program.
Always good to have you here. Now, Charlie, we hear that term per capita personal income in countless news reports, but for those of us whose high school or college econ class is but a distant memory, tell us exactly what personal income means.
Well, for most people, it's their wages and salaries. A whole lot of families have, that's either all or like 99% of their income is how much they earn from an employer. But it also includes things like Social Security and dividends, interest, rents, and royalties. The way the Commerce Department counts these things, it doesn't include Medicare. And it doesn't include the capital gains on your stock market portfolio. But for most people, it's a pretty good indication. Now, you said per capita personal income. Mm-hmm. So what it is they add up all of the income of all of the people in Michigan, and then they just divide by the number of people. In other words, that doesn't say anything about how that income is distributed. It just gives you the average.
Okay, so we've got that set. This whole report from the Commerce Department, where they're looking at income for 2011, and we get a breakdown by county and by our state. So first, let's talk about the overall state. Michigan's per capita personal income rose 5.7% to $36,264. What does that mean?
Well, like so many things, it's a good news, bad news scenario. The good news is that we, really for 3 years now, we have been making progress out of the very deep hole of the first decade of the 21st century, which was really, let's face it, a crummy decade for Michigan's economy. We've had 3 years of progress. That's good. The not-so-good news is that we still remain about 13% below the national average. Michigan is a state that in the heyday of manufacturing in the 50s and 60s, we were well above the national average. We've only been above the national average twice in the last 25 years. So, we're headed in the right direction, but there's still a ways to go.
And as far as the overall state, you are offering some cautionary words about these numbers. So tell us more about that.
Well, yeah. If you're improving, if your numbers are getting better, there's two ways for that to happen. One is you're good and you're getting better. The other is you're sort of recovering from a not so good. It's the latter that we're in, where we had some room to grow, I think, because there was so much slack in the Michigan economy. Now we're a little bit less slack than we were. Our state's unemployment rate is down from in the 14s to in the 8s and 9s. We're making progress, but like I say, we're coming off such a really really horrendous decade. And that means that we've still got a lot of people in Michigan who are not doing very well.
In fact, let's look at that. We get a breakdown by county. Let's start with who are some of the winners as far as areas in Michigan and counties in Michigan who have seen growth?
Well, Oakland County is a county that did quite well in between 2010 and 2011. And they are the most affluent county in Michigan, Birmingham, Bloomfield Hills. But that did not get them back to where they were 5 years ago.
Mm.
So, again, it's sort of this good news, bad news thing. We're doing better, but we are also coming out of by far the worst economic downturn since the 1930s. So Oakland County did quite well. Huron County, up in the Thumb, did very well. Now, of course, when a small, relatively rural county does well, at least part of it is you may not have a whole lot of people. So when you're taking the per capita, you're dividing by the number of people. Well, the number of people is small. It used to be that Loving County, Texas, had the highest per capita income in the nation, and that's because it's way out in the middle of nowhere, and there was a couple of guys with a lot of income, and it had the smallest population.
You
got to take all these numbers with at least a couple of grains of salt.
And for the areas that really are not doing well and we did not see much growth, same type of thing. You have to kind of look at it that way. I know UP had some very low-performing counties.
And, you know, the UP, for better or worse, the population of the Upper Peninsula is lower now than it was in 1910.
Mm.
It is a region that has not had a whole lot of economic growth for a very, very long time. And some of the poorest counties in the state are up there and in the northern Lower Peninsula. Although the northwestern Lower Peninsula, places like Grand Traverse County, Charlevoix, Leelanau County, they are among the more affluent. One that didn't do well was Ingham County, where I live, where Lansing and East Lansing. And I think that may be at least partly because of the retrenchment of the state government.
Ah, okay. Let's ask in general then, do you think the numbers we're talking about, the report from the Commerce Department, are they pointing to a recovery that is strong and encouraging or one that's weak and tentative?
I'd say sort of in between those.
Hmm.
It's not a weak recovery. It's a halfway decent recovery. I like to use, since we're in a automotive state, I like to use an automotive metaphor. It feels to me like we've sort of shifted from second gear maybe into third gear.
Okay.
We're not in fourth. We're not in overdrive. But considering that 4 years ago, 3 years ago, we were in reverse, third gear feels okay. It's not as good as I'd like to be, but we're headed in the right direction.
So we are talking about what looks like a going into third gear recovery. I like that that way of describing it. Areas seem to be getting stronger. People are spending, and yet it seems we cannot turn on the news without hearing those two words, fiscal cliff. In fact, some on cable TV have even taken to using terms like fiscal Armageddon. So help us out a little. What does the fiscal cliff, in your opinion, really mean for us in Michigan?
Well, it is certainly not Armageddon. And even cliff is awfully strong. Maybe we should call it a fiscal ramp or a fiscal slide. Last year, after some very contentious negotiations, President Obama and the House Republicans reached a deal, and they passed this Budget Control Act that sort of set a poison pill that would take effect on January 1st, 2013, with some big tax cuts and some sort of MEDAX approach cuts to spending. And the idea was those would be so bad that it would force the Congress to act in a responsible way.
Hmm.
Well, so far that hasn't happened, but I really do believe that it probably is going to happen. Now, what if it doesn't happen by midnight on January 1st?
Right.
That's not the end of the world. These tax increases, if your tax goes up for one day and then they fix it on New Year's and it's back to normal on January 2nd, well, that's not so bad. It's only if it goes on for weeks and weeks and months that we really begin to have the kind of drag on the economy that could push us back into recession. If they don't fix it at all, and if we really slam on the brakes with heavy tax increases and spending cuts, then we could have a recession. But I really don't think that'll happen. I think they will be able to come up with a deal that is sort of mildly moving toward deficit reduction, but not doing it in this crazy way.
Because I was thinking about this and just looking around at people in my world who are working after some lean times, or people who are perhaps finally able to sell their homes because real estate prices are getting stronger, so they're not as likely to be as underwater as a couple of years ago. And I think there's a sense of, don't mess this up.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's we see it in the survey numbers for my State of the State survey. Let's face it, people's trust in government is not all that high, and it's partly because of this kind of stalemate. But I do believe that it's quite likely that we'll get some kind of a deal that will move us in the direction of deficit reduction, which is good, but not do it in such an abrupt way as to really toss the economy back into a recession. So it's not done yet, and honestly, the way these negotiations go, I don't think it'll be fixed until, you know, at the earliest 11:53 p.m. on New Year's Eve. But I do believe, and we've seen some signs, some members of Congress being a little bit more conciliatory. So I'm hopeful that a deal will be struck.
We have even heard it from House Speaker Boehner, haven't we? Well, maybe we could be open to some movement.
Something, yes. Speaker Boehner is a man in a very difficult position. I think fundamentally, down in his DNA, what he wants to do is make a deal. But he's got a caucus in the House of Representatives, many of whom are very strident and don't want to make a deal. But he's trying to push them in what I think is the responsible direction. Last year, Boehner and Obama came very close to a deal, mm-hmm. but the more extreme elements of the House of Representatives wouldn't let it happen. I think it's going to happen this time.
Michigan State University economics professor Charlie Ballard, always good to talk with you. Thanks for sharing your insights with us today on Stateside.
Thanks very much, Cindy.
Still to come, we continue our look at higher education in Michigan as we ask, in this day and age, is it really possible to get through college without racking up huge student loans? Ways to reduce student debt. That's in 10 minutes here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, continuing our look at the problem of student debt. When students are in the middle of classes and reading and exams and papers and going through the process of getting that degree and trying for good grades, it's kind of hard to keep your eye on the horizon beyond the grind of daily classes. Thinking about the job search and post-grad classes and paying off those student loans, it's often just more than someone can handle. But then you graduate, and then you are smacked by the reality that it is payback time, even as you're trying to find a job in your field or go to grad school. Then what? Well, Amanda Page has been wrestling with this problem ever since graduating from the University of Michigan 9 years ago. Yep. Amanda, now you graduated with a degree in Egyptian archaeology and classical civilization.
Yes.
Okay, what drew you to that?
I started off in engineering, like a lot of people do, and found that it was not necessarily something that I was passionate about. I wasn't invested in it enough to deal with all of the boring classes that you have to take before you can take the fun classes. So freshman year, I remember being in Professor Sue Alcock's Intro to Field Archaeology class. And I was like, oh, I remember I can dig in the dirt and play with old things. And I'm really passionate about this. And this is cool. This is what I want to do. So I was like, I'm dropping out of engineering and going to LSNA. And I'm going to go play in the dirt for the rest of my life. And had these grand romantic ideas of field archaeology and being a professor and all these wonderful things. And yeah.
And it's 9 years later.
Yes.
And what's happened?
I started college in 96. And in 99, I fell in love and got married and got pregnant. And then things sort of fell apart.
Okay.
And so I left school and went into the real world, as it were, and couldn't find a job in the field. Yeah. So I started in just wherever I could get a job. And then that one ended, and then I went to another job, and then that one ended, and then went to another job, and one day woke up and was like, I really hate my job. I don't want to do a job for the rest of my life. I need to go back to school. So I sort of slogged through it and went back to school, worked full time, went to school full time, and was a mom full time. And worked through that, got through school, graduated, and yay. And now I've got these two degrees and I'm super smart, and people are like, oh, that's so interesting, but there is not a lot of jobs in my field.
And the student debt's looming to the
student
tune of?
Student debt is looming to the tune of, I want to say about
$60,000. Okay, it's a lot of money.
It's a lot. It's a very daunting number to be faced with. And unfortunately, I did the ostrich approach to my student loan.
Which
and
was?
Sort of buried my head in sand.
Okay.
So time is accruing, and payments were occasionally getting made, but not on a regular basis because I wasn't really making that much money at the time.
Can I ask how much a month your payment was for your loan?
Oh, I want to say it was maybe a couple $100. So it wasn't too terribly bad, but when you're making $9 an hour and trying to support a kid,
it is terribly bad.
It is terribly bad.
Sure.
So Underworld went out of business. And I started working for Automobile Magazine. And by that time, payments had sort of fallen off to the wayside. And they stopped sending me letters, so I stopped paying attention to them.
Okay.
And that's not a good sign when they stop sending you letters. But we'll get to that,
okay.
I'm sure.
All right.
So I worked for Automobile for a while. And then they changed hands. And I got laid off. So by the time I thought I was ready to start paying off my loans, that job ended in money dried up, and default land was where I was building a home.
And then ultimately, you had career plans for your classical studies in Egyptian archaeology, but in order to move ahead, you needed higher, more degrees.
Exactly. You need to have at least a master's, preferably a PhD, in order to go into the field of academia anywhere, ever. And because I've defaulted, the federal government is like, we're not giving you any more money. So unless I can save up money, which is really hard, I can't pay for school anymore. So I can't go and get my master's.
It really does seem like a complete and total catch-22.
It is. It is very much a catch-22. And it's a, you're constantly playing catch-up, and it's really difficult to get ahead.
And meanwhile, back at the lack of letters.
Yes, back at the lack of letters means that they go, okay, we're going to stop playing nice for you, and we're going to put you into default status. And that is sort of the haunted graveyard of student debt. And once you go into default, they want to make it really easy for you to get out. They say, make 9 payments on time every month, and we'll take you out of default status. We won't erase your loans, but you'll get out of default status, and they'll try and help you more.
What does it mean to be in default status in terms of your everyday life and trying to just get through things?
In terms of your everyday life, your student loans are sort of that healthy debt, and my credit is wrecked. So that means that I can't get a credit card to help me with emergencies. I have to sort of operate on a generally mostly cash basis. I don't really have a savings to speak of because my job is great, does not pay the most. And I can't move up to that next pay scale because it's hard for employers to sort of justify paying the wages to somebody who just has a bachelor's.
What do you wish, looking back, that someone had told you about college and student loans before you embarked on all of this?
Before I embarked on all of this, I think I wish somebody had said, when you get your financial aid package, they're going to give you a lot more money than you necessarily need. A lot of it's probably going to be in loans. You don't have to take them all. That's what I wish somebody would have told me, is you don't have to take it all. You, as long as your tuition is covered and your expenses are covered, then don't get that big refund check because you're going to do something stupid because you're 18 and don't know any better. I wish someone had said you could probably be more aggressive in looking for scholarships. Scholarship planning does not end when you graduate from high school.
Amanda, thanks for sharing your story with
us
today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
That was Amanda Page, wrestling with student debt ever since graduating from the University of Michigan 9 years ago. So we've heard how it's all too easy to graduate with that shiny new college degree and a crushing mountain of student debt. If parents have co-signed, sometimes that debt comes due just as the parents are looking at retirement, and suddenly they may have a huge financial challenge in having to pay off their child's school debt. At the same time, studies have proven that across the country, the top income earners are, in nearly every case, college educated. So, what should parents and college students do to help boost that student's chance of graduating without crushing student loans? Could it be possible to get through college without encouraging big loans that need to be paid back? Joining us now is Detroit Free Press financial columnist Susan Tompor, and also Pam Fowler. She's the Executive Director of Financial Aid at the University of Michigan. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Susan, I want to start with you because I know you have been sounding the drumbeat of warning to parents and college students in the pages of the Free Press with your columns. Just how have we gotten to the point where you see students struggling with $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 in student debt?
Well, I think one of the ways we get to this point, and we talk about this $1 trillion mark, that's really been the headline that's giving everybody a headache, really, $1 trillion in student loan debt. And when you talk to people, some of the problems that arise is actually students don't keep track of how much they're borrowing. There's a big concern, you know, when you go out and buy a car, one of the first things a borrower is going to ask is, what's my monthly payment? That's not how it's structured when you go out and take on student loan debt. People don't, you know, run through the numbers or understand, well, is this going to be a $90 a month payment? Is this going to be a $300 a month payment? You know, where am I going with this? And that is so important to keep track of those loans. And there's a difference between private loans and federal loans, and some people do not understand the advantage of a federal loan, which, you know, there are more caps on rates and some better repayment plans on some of those federal loans. You know, they kind of mix them up and they don't know what they have. So I think that's where we get started. And I also think part of the issue is, you know, everyone thinks you need a degree, and that, you know, it's important, but what degree are you going to get? Is this going to be, you know, from what school, what are you going to study? Where are you borrowing it from? And I like to think about that monthly payment, and there's some more calculators online really to research, you know, what are we going to do here? Where are we going to end up?
Pam Fowler, as Executive Director of Financial Aid at U of M, what's your take on this?
Well, I agree that students don't keep track. Financial aid officers go out of their way to give students the tools that they need to do that. But I think it starts earlier, as Susan was saying, is where the degree is going to come from, what type of degree, how long it's going to take to get that degree. Students used to graduate in 4 years. They don't graduate in 4 years any longer. We calculate, because the government requires us to do so, a six-year graduation rate. Well, one certainly borrows a lot more in 6 years than you do in 4 years. So you need to, at the onset, regardless of what institution you enroll in, try to get out in 4 years. And that may limit your course of study or your other options. Sometimes we send students mixed messages. The financial aid office is saying, get out in a hurry so that you limit your borrowing. But the academic side may be saying you need to take advantage of this, and this, study abroad, dual majors, expanded degree studies, and that kind of thing, not realizing that they're encouraging the student to incur more debt. By the time the student comes to the institution, planning is probably, it's a little late to plan to go to school. So you have to see if there's something you can do at that late stage of the game to limit debt. And in most cases, there's not.
And really, is some of this just our era? I mean, we are really in an era where parents are starting looking for the top school, even in preschool.
That's correct.
Do you both see that?
I think some of it is our era, and maybe we don't look at our income limitations as much because we do pretty much all understand that an education is important. No one, I think, would disagree with that. But the key question is, what are you going to pay, and, you know, how can you defer some of those costs? Another thing people get confused in is, you know, this idea of applying to the better schools. And some people are confused when they get these acceptance notes. They might not understand if this is a loan
or if it's a grant, or maybe sometimes what the experts have been telling me is some schools may front load some of these benefits. So maybe in the first year, you may get more aid that is not have to be repaid back, you know, in a form that's not a loan.
Ah.
But so you think, oh, I'll get that in the second year. Maybe not. Maybe the school front loads a lot of the benefits. And the second year, you're going to end up borrowing more. I've talked to parents who face that consideration. So here you are at the school. You made the choice. Yes, we think we can do this. But the second year, your financial aid isn't nearly as great.
We just ran our interview with Amanda, who loved her Egyptian archaeology and classical studies classes at U of M and graduated 9 years ago, more than $60,000 in debt, wound up defaulting on her loans and cannot pay for the master's and the doctorate level degrees that she needs to continue in her field. She started in engineering and found it unfulfilling, didn't like it, loved the archaeology and classical studies, so there she went. One has to ask, is it a bad idea for someone to graduate with a major like archaeology? Should they be turning their backs on that?
Throw that to Pam.
I don't ever tell a student what they should or should not major in. I just point out the consequences of a major. And graduating from U of M with $60,000 in debt, I would think that she was a non-resident student when she came to Michigan, which means she paid much higher tuition. And we have this conversation in our office all the time with non-resident parents saying, we don't ever say you can't afford to come to Michigan because that doesn't sit well with families. But we will say perhaps you should consider a lower cost or an in-state alternative to our non-resident families. But once again, the student has always wanted to come to Michigan, and you know, and it's like, and so they divorce the practical decision from the emotional decision, and they go with the emotional decision. Now, there are options for students who have large amount of debt to keep their payments low. There are income-based repayment programs where, and under the current regulations, which just went into effect, if a student makes a monthly payment for 20 years, down from 25. The balance of the loan is forgiven, and it is based on 10% of one's discretionary income. So if I'm only working as a waitress and I have, say I had $10,000 in debt and I'm working as a waitress, I only have to pay what the formula says my income will allow me to pay. So I don't go into default. I continue to make my payments, and, you know, life isn't as good as it could have been, but it's not in default and bad credit and all those things that go along with that.
And Susan, you spend much of your space in the Free Press as you write columns about student debt just over and over saying, do not default. And the reason is?
The reason is you run up, the worst side of it is you can get run into some bad legal consequences. You know, they are taking people to court on some of these cases, and it really becomes a huge problem. But on the other side, you might not be able to get a cell phone plan, a rent, signing up for utilities. These are all problems that you're going to have, you know, with daily living. It goes on your credit report. It's a big issue. One of the things that, you know, we were talking about, what major? Some people give guidelines as to what's the salary. Think about what, you know, if I'm going to be making $40,000 a year, why would I borrow $100,000, right?
Right.
So start thinking in guidelines, what does the salary traditionally pay, and how much do I need to borrow, and how would that be doable? And there are some good programs now on these income-based repayment. I went online and looked at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and there's a little bit of a nice step-by-step plan that parents and students can look at. It's www.cfpb.gov, and it really talks in a very simple manner, asking you to look at whether your loans are federal or private, and asking how much do you think, you know, are you going to have trouble making the monthly payments? And it kind of walks you in step by step. They talk about the income-based repayment plan. They list some examples. One example was if your income was $35,000 and you had three members in the family, it could break it down to $90 a month on a payment. So there are some different programs. Again, federal is better, so that's always the best. If you've got federal, take those loans out first. you do have to look into these things and talk to your servicer and see what options are out there. And if there's true economic hardship, say you don't have a job, there's deferment programs, forbearances. You know, there are different programs to avoid the default. The default is probably the worst thing you could do. You don't want to, you know, say, oh, I can't make the payment. That's it. I'm done. I'm not going to contact anybody.
Pam?
Well, if you get to that point and you don't want to contact the lender because you can't make the payments, then contact the school, and hopefully someone in the financial aid office can talk to you about your options and put you in contact with either the federal servicer or the private lender who can help you get back on track. And it is possible to rehabilitate a defaulted loan, but you have to make nine consecutive monthly payments on time and that kind of thing. But it's much better not to get to that position in the first place.
It's been great talking with both of you. Really appreciate your assistance. And Susan Tomper, who, of course, is the Detroit Free Press personal financial columnist, and Pam Fowler, Executive Director of Financial Aid at the University of Michigan. Thanks for talking with us
You're
today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
And we've put a link to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau on our website. Just go to michiganradio.org. Coming up next, we meet a man who's been photographing the shoreline of the Great Lakes, all 10,000 miles of it. This is Michigan Radio, and you're listening to Stateside. It's a pretty good bet that if you live in Michigan, you have at one time or another walked or driven alongside one of the Great Lakes. It's something that makes us all feel like Michiganders. Maybe you have your favorite slice of Great Lakes shoreline, perhaps Caseville, East Tawas, the Leelanau, maybe Grand Haven or Ludington. But how often do you think of the entire system and shoreline of the Great Lakes, all 10,000 miles of shoreline that runs along 8 states and 1 Canadian province? Photographer Ed Wargen is thinking about the Great Lakes as one entire region because he's in the middle of a project called the Fresh Coast Project. He's photographing all of the shoreline of the Great Lakes. Ed Wargen joins us now. Welcome, Ed.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. Tell us, when and how did you come up with the idea of this enormous project of photographing all 10,000 miles of shoreline of the Great Lakes?
Well, you know, the idea of the project really goes back many, many years, but I've actually been working on it most seriously over the last several years. However, I grew up in Duluth, Minnesota, Lake Superior's most western port city, and so I've always had that love affair with the Great Lakes, starting with Lake Superior. And being a photographer, it's just been a natural transition to follow those shorelines and to capture. But as my career developed, I became closer and closer to wanting to tell and share the story of the Great Lakes. And I've realized as well over the years, living and working through the Great Lakes, that we often look at the Great Lakes as parts and pieces. Again, being from Duluth originally, we have the North Shore. But we lived in Michigan for about 10 years, and you have the Sleeping Bear Dunes, and we kind of have this tendency to kind of break down the Great Lakes in parts and pieces.
Very true.
And the goal of the project is to try to look at the Great Lakes as one story. So it's literally one photograph at a time to create one story on the Great Lakes and to hopefully have us look at it a little bit different.
So you're taking still photographs?
Everything is still photographs. And more importantly, it's all being photographed on film, which is an archival method. I shoot on a transparency type based film, which is it's very beautiful and it's very archival, which I think is very important to the integrity of the project. The goal is to have this library of images be around for generations, and I feel the best way to do that is to capture it on film.
So give us an idea of how you do this. Are you doing it from the land looking out? Are you renting boats and doing it from the water looking back onto the land?
I'm really approaching it from really all various angles, but typically, by far and away, it's from the shoreline. I like the idea of the Great Lakes being approachable for people and not have it be in an intimidating landscape. So I do like the idea of photographing from shore the majority of the time, but I have done over the years for the project aerial photography and a photograph from kayaks and various boats. So it's really all of those things.
The logistics are mind-blowing when you think of 10,000 miles of shoreline. And my understanding is you also want to do it in all four seasons?
Yeah, I actually have been capturing this project in all four seasons. And at the end of the day, there'll be invariably many places that I have to think that I will not capture. Mm-hmm. But it's to build that framework. I would feel really lucky, I guess, that if what I do is I encourage other people to go out and to capture their own story on the Great Lakes in the years ahead. Maybe this is a starting point, but I have built a very large framework of imagery on the Great Lakes, and I think I'm off to a great start.
I want to talk more about what you referenced a bit earlier about how important it is to you to do this project on film as opposed to digital. What are we losing out on by moving into purely digital photography?
Well, the way I look at it, and it's, in my opinion, is that when I'm photographing on film and I'm done processing that film and it comes back from the lab, I'm literally holding that piece of film in my hand. And that is a key part. It's so tangible. I cannot do that with a digital file. And I shoot digital photography as well. But I often say to people, try to imagine holding a digital file. You can't. Mm-hmm. It's interpolated data. So I do have a love affair with shooting on film. It's something that I've been doing since a very young age. And it's capturing that moment in time. When someone looks at a piece of film or a piece of film from this project, that's exactly what it looked like at that moment. It's a matter of what you see is what you get. And that's what I like about working on film.
Are you shooting in color or black and white, Ed?
In color.
In color. And you tell us that the clock's ticking on your project. Why so?
Well, as a matter of fact, earlier this year, Kodak has stopped manufacturing this certain film and chemicals that I shoot and work with. Mm-hmm. I am working with what's left in the marketplace. So there is a clock now attached to this project. I've had the luxury to capture this, I wouldn't say at my leisure. There's always been that I knew this day would come, but when they stopped manufacturing the product, the time has definitely come to get this on film while I can.
You talk about the enormous changes along the Great Lakes shoreline over the past 75 years, and you say you want to capture the transition from old to new. Tell us more about that.
Well, I'm intrigued with the idea that if we just simply look back 75 years ago, we had lumber camps, we had lighthouses and lightkeepers, we had commercial fishermen and commercial fishing villages. And in that short time frame, from an historical perspective, it's changed. Most of that is gone. We might see remnants of that through lighthouses and historic sites that are fishing villages, but essentially that lifestyle, those types of lifestyles are gone. And I look at it from the perspective of today, the work that I'm doing on the Great Lakes today, and what will it look like 75 years from now? It's going to be radically different because there's a little bit of irony in that I'm pining about looking back 75 years with no lighthouse keepers, and I'm literally racing against time because I think this will be the last project that I do on film. So clearly, 75 years from now, people will look back at this and it'll be kind of a double reflection of what I was looking at and looking at how film clearly will have been long gone by that time. So I feel like this project is kind of bridging a gap between the past and the future, and that's, I think, what really intrigues me.
I think, in a sense, your words bring to mind my feelings when I look at Matthew Brady's photographs of Civil War battlefields. So I understand what you're saying about what future generations might think as they look back at your images.
Exactly. And it's a little, I find it a little strange to talk about it in these terms, but as much as this project is about engaging people to look at the Great Lakes today, it's really about the generations from now that will look at this project through the lens of what the Great Lakes look like during this time. And it's a little bit harder to convince people to sometimes look at a project in that way because we're all living in the present, of course.
Sure.
But I guess as an artist, you can only hope that you'll have some sort of impact on the narrative years down the road.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we're speaking with photographer Ed Worgen about his Fresh Coast project. He is shooting all the shoreline of the Great Lakes, and he's doing it on film. Ed, how long have you been doing this? You said several years.
I've been working seriously on the project for the past decade or so. It's really been the last 4 to 5 years where it's been all-consuming. Again, you go back to it's a very large project in scope, and it's very expensive. So it's a project that gets done in parts and pieces, sometimes due to funding constraints, but other times it might be based on times of years and seasons and whatnot. So it's been a real fun, creative patchwork to get this project done, and I think we're looking at probably easily less than a year, and all filming will be complete on my end.
In this stretch of time, you have to have some very interesting travel war stories and interesting people that you've encountered. Can you share any of those memories with us?
I think in some ways that's the best part because it's the part that I don't necessarily share through the projects. Those are the parts and pieces that I take with me that are really special. You meet some really wonderful people. There's so many stories that really go with that, and I'm probably picking one of the oddest ones, but it's the one that jumps to mind.
Go ahead.
And I was working up in the Pitchard Rocks National Lakeshore, and I had gotten up well before sunrise and was walking towards the Osabo Lighthouse. And it's about a three-quarters of a mile walk through this trail and completely doing it in the pitch dark. And I'm heading down the trail. I finally start to see a little bit of open light. I see the lighthouse in the distance, and the sun is just starting to pop up over the horizon of Lake Superior. And I'm clearly all by myself. It's a little bit off season, and I start sighting up, and lo and behold, there's a person standing 40 yards off to the left of me. It was a woman. She didn't have any shoes or socks on, and she scared me.
I
jumped pretty high, but we struck up a conversation, and to find out that she had was walking across America, not in bare feet, I don't think, but she was at that time when I saw her. But she was from Washington D.C. and was walking across America, and I encountered her in this very far-flung landscape, and it's those kinds of situations where you meet people that they get your heart racing, they make life very exciting.
I think there's a book to be written there, don't you?
There very well might be.
As you talk about the personalities of the people you've encountered, now that you've become so intimately acquainted with the Great Lakes, maybe I'm off base here, but are there different personalities of the lakes? Have you discovered that?
I really do think there are different personalities to the lakes, and I think the citizens that live in and around those Great Lakes drive those personalities. What I like so much is there's like particular pride with certain lakes, and I think the one lake that carries so much pride is Lake Michigan, and I think that's probably because so much of it is beach-oriented, and it brings so many people to its shores, whether they're cottagers or visitors or what have you, and I think all it does is it just creates so many fond memories for people. The personality trait that I find with Lake Superior that seems to be true over and over again is there's such awe. People look at that lake with such respect and in some cases almost fear, and some of them might be driven from, you know, past events like the Edmund Fitzgerald sinking to, you know, people have been there when these storms kick up. And it makes you realize how small you are. So there's this idea of respect that comes with Lake Superior.
How about Huron?
What I find about Lake Huron is I was probably, of all the five Great Lakes, most surprised by Lake Huron. Simply being on the American side of the lake, you get a sense of what it feels like over in the thumb. Uh-huh. There's also that sense of pride on the lakeshore there. But when you're on the Canadian side, when you're over on the Bruce Peninsula, it is, to me, it was probably the most, felt the most reminiscent of almost like being on a beach in California. When you're looking over Lake Huron to the west, facing California, if you will, facing Michigan, if
yeah,
you will,
yeah.
The cottage lifestyle is a little bit different. There's sandwich shops and ice cream parlors, and it just goes on and on through these cottagey type villages that run up the shore of the Bruce Peninsula, and you get a whole different sense of their lifestyle. Is very, it's a very upbeat summer lifestyle. A lot of the cottagers there are from Toronto, and it just has a really nice feel. And Lake Erie, I find really intriguing because Lake Erie's been through a lot.
Yes.
Lake Erie gets picked on and beat up, but there's a lot of pride with the fact that it's coming back, that a lot of people have put a lot of time, money, effort into preservation. And is it perfect? No. But is it coming back? I would say absolutely. And I think that's what makes Lake Erie so wonderful. And lastly, Lake Ontario, it's probably the most unique cottage culture. I know when a lot of people from the heart of the Great Lakes think of cottages, they think Michigan, but the cottage culture in the Thousand Islands, both mm-hmm. in the American and the Canadian side, is phenomenal. It's pretty common to go into to someone's cottage there, and they'll have a sign-in or a logbook that literally goes back to the early 1800s, where these cottages are 8, 9, and 10 generations, and makes my family roots feel very young.
Yeah, that's true.
And
a lot of history.
On history. And
yeah.
And to go into these cottages that are might be one cottage on one island, it's just it's a pretty warming experience.
The website is thefreshcoastproject.com. Ed Morgan's work is there, and we have put a link up on our page at michiganradio.org so you can check out the work. And what will you do with all of these images, Ed, when you're done?
There's a few bit of unknowns there, but the goal is to search out and to have a hopefully have a hardcover book published of the final work. Another goal is to build out hopefully some fine art photographic print exhibitions that ideally my goal, lofty goal, would be to have those travel through the Great Lakes to universities, because I believe in my heart that the next stewards of the Great Lakes are the young people, and I would love to have an exhibition of the work travel through different universities and colleges in the Great Lakes region, but only time will tell.
Ed Morgan, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside. It's been great getting to hear your stories.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate your time.
Photographer Ed Morgan, who is doing the Fresh Coast Project, and again, you can find his images with the link up on our page at michiganradio.org. And as we are talking about the Great Lakes, we thought we'd let you know Governor Rick Snyder has been named co-chair of the Council of Great Lakes Governors beginning in January. He'll chair the nonpartisan council along with Illinois Governor Pat Quinn. Together, the council says the pair will lead efforts to protect and restore the Great Lakes and combat threats like the invasive Asian carp. Governor Snyder says protecting the Great Lakes is one of his highest priorities. Meantime, the governor will deliver a special message about energy and the environment tomorrow morning. In the past, he's used these types of special messages to discuss his goals for public safety and education. And the governor will join us on Stateside tomorrow afternoon at 3 to talk about the special address. So let us know what questions you would like to ask the governor about your environment. Tweet us at Stateside Radio. Find us on Facebook at Stateside with Cynthia Canty. Or you can, of course, find us online, michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered by Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow at 3:00.